Welcome to the 13th edition of News of the Church. It's the 2nd of June of 2025. It's Monday after Ascension Thursday, and we commemorate today Saints Marcellinus and Peter, so I will have to remember to bow my head at their names in the Roman canon when saying Mass. Some time ago, I saw a movie called News of the World, in which, years after the Civil War, a former Confederate officer scratches out a living as a gazetteer. He travels from town to town and reads aloud stories from different newspapers, and people pay a dime to listen. That's 10 cents a head, which is about $2.50 today. The idea caught my imagination, and so here I am, a gazetteer for you. Since we are at the beginning of a month that is traditionally dedicated to devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, it is a perhaps appropriate thing to read a little bit about the Sacred Heart and June. I found at the site of the Archdiocese of San Francisco something that was published last year, and it's written by Aaron Lambert, and it's really quite good. Reclaiming June for the Sacred Heart of Jesus. While the month of June has been claimed by a prideful modern culture to celebrate falsified love and distorted identity, it's important for Catholics to remember that June belonged to the Church first. Each June, the Church dedicates the entire month to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, where it offers special prayers and gives special attention to the Sacred Heart devotion. The reason for this is because the Feast of the Sacred Heart usually falls in the month of June. Since the 17th century, the month of June has been connected to the Sacred Heart. It began to be recognized as the month of the Sacred Heart of Jesus as early as 1790, and continued to develop through the 18th and 19th centuries. The Sacred Heart devotion is practiced and beloved by many all around the world, and in dedicating the month of June to it, the Church places great trust in this devotion. Writing in his 1956 encyclical Haureitis Aquas on devotion to the Sacred Heart, Pope Pius XII said, "The Church has always valued, and still does, the devotion to the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus so highly that she provides for the spread of it among Christian peoples everywhere and by every means." Even though June has taken on a different, more secular meaning, there has been in recent years a renewed call within the Church to reclaim the month of June. Just last year, podcaster Matt Frad of the popular Pints with Aquinas podcast used his platform to promote a Reclaim the Month t-shirt, and the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops went viral by tweeting a reminder that June is dedicated to the Sacred Heart. In order to properly reclaim the month, however, some basic history and education in the Sacred Heart devotion, and more importantly, the promises Jesus made to those who practice the devotion, is in order. As with many of the pious and popular devotions of the Church, the Sacred Heart devotion began as a private revelation that gradually became more known and grew in popularity over the years. The origins of the devotion can be traced back as early as the 11th and 12th centuries to various monasteries that practiced an early form of it. However, the devotion in its modern form began on December 27, 1673, with a nun named Sister Margaret Mary Alacoque, who lived at a monastery in eastern France. Jesus appeared to her in a series of apparitions and visions over the course of 18 months, in which he revealed the mystery of his Sacred Heart to her. Sister Margaret Mary reported that Jesus told her, "Behold the heart which has so loved men that it has spared nothing, even to exhausting and consuming itself, in order to testify its love. I promise you that my heart shall expand itself to shed in abundance the influence of its divine love upon those who shall thus honor it and cause it to be honored." Among the revelations Jesus shared with Sister Margaret were specific acts of piety to venerate his Sacred Heart. These included a Thursday holy hour, the creation of the Feast of the Sacred Heart following the Feast of Corpus Christi, and what has become known as the First Friday devotion, where devotees receive the Eucharist on the first Friday of each month. In addition to these pious acts, Jesus also revealed 12 promises to Sister Margaret Mary, for those who practice devotion to His Sacred Heart. I will give them all the graces necessary in their state of life. I will establish peace in their homes. I will comfort them in all their afflictions. I will be their secure refuge during life and above all in death. I will bestow abundant blessings upon all their undertakings. Sinners will find in my heart the source and infinite ocean of mercy. Lukewarm souls shall become fervent. Fervent souls shall quickly mount to high perfection. I will bless every place in which an image of my heart is exposed and honored. I will give to priests the gift of touching the most hardened hearts. Those who shall promote this devotion shall have their names written in my heart. I promise you, in the excessive mercy of my heart, that my all-powerful love will grant to all those who receive Holy Communion on the first Fridays in 9 consecutive months the grace of final perseverance. They shall not die in my disgrace, nor without receiving their sacraments. My divine heart shall be their safe refuge in this last moment. Just to interrupt for a moment, recently I had the occasion to sing the Litany of Saints once on the parish pilgrimage in Rome to the Holy Door in St. Peter's, and then we had the litanies, the Litany of Saints for the Rogation days. And so one of the most important of the intercessions, or the prayers, petitions rather, in the Litany of the Saints is that we ask God to spare us from a sudden and unprovided death. And the promises of the Sacred Heart really tie very much into that, don't they? I'll continue now with this piece from the Archdiocese of San Francisco. Many were skeptical of Sister Margaret Mary's visions and her claims of what Jesus revealed to her. Although she died in 1690, her testimony successfully laid the ground for the devotion to grow and flourish. As time passed and the devotion became more popular in France, the Vatican eventually granted the Feast of the Sacred Heart to France in 1765, nearly 100 years after the original apparitions. Then, in 1856, after persistent appeals by the French bishops at the time, Pope Pius IX established the Feast of the Sacred Heart for the Universal Church, to be celebrated following the octave of Corpus Christi. Sister Margaret Mary was eventually canonized in 1920. In the years that have followed, devotion to the Sacred Heart has grown to be one of the most popular and powerful forms of devotion in the Church. Many saints have a deep devotion to the Sacred Heart, including St. Alphonsus Liguori, St. John Bosco, St. Francis Cabrini, and St. Maximilian Kolbe. These saints and many others who are devoted to the Sacred Heart have attested that this devotion is one of the best ways to grow in holiness. In describing the devotion, Pope Pius XI, in his 1928 encyclical Miserentissimus Redemptor, on reparation to the Sacred Heart, summed it up when he wrote, "For is not the sum of all religion, and therefore the pattern of more perfect life, contained in that most auspicious sign, and in the form of piety that follows from it, inasmuch as it more readily leads the minds of men to an intimate knowledge of Christ our Lord, and more efficaciously moves their hearts to love Him more vehemently and to imitate Him more closely." The Sacred Heart of Jesus contains within it a richness and vibrancy that also, as it were, reveals the heart of the Christian faith. After all, if the heart itself is a symbol of both the true depths of love and the very core of a person, then it follows that to know and love Jesus' heart is to deeply know Him and experience the depths of His love, an inexhaustible, ever-flowing stream of love which perpetually pours forth from His Sacred Heart for all of creation. The love of the Sacred Heart of Jesus stands in stark contrast to the false version of love that the secular culture celebrates in June. It is that mysterious and perfect love of Christ that the Church honors instead, and the one that the world needs more witnesses to, especially in June. May the body of Christ reclaim the month of June for the Sacred Heart of Jesus, for it is there, in His Sacred Heart, that the fulfillment of true love lies, and we find our deepest identity as loved children of God, where our restless souls can find true rest. Oh, that was a piece that was published by the Archdiocese of San Francisco. And just at the end there, we have a little reference to St. Augustine, don't we? Our hearts are restless until they rest in you, O God. And therefore, I'm reminded of the fact that we have a new pope, Pope Leo XIV, who is an Augustinian, and he has on his coat of arms the heart that is pierced with an arrow. And so we tie that together with the election of our new pope. Well, we turn from the depths of the human person to the depths of space. I like to include a little space news in these short podcasts. And once again, Voyager is giving us some interesting news. This is back from, three pieces, actually. I've got one from March 5th, from the 14th of May, and one from just a couple of days ago. So let's see if I can stitch this together without making it about 45 minutes. Okay, here we go. NASA mission engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California turned off the cosmic rays subsystem experiment aboard Voyager 1 on February 25th and will shut off Voyager 2's low-energy charged particle instrument on March 24th. Three science instruments will continue to operate on each spacecraft. The moves are part of an ongoing effort to manage the gradually diminishing power supply of the twin probes. Launched in 1977, Voyagers 1 and 2 rely on radioisotope power systems that generate electricity from the heat of decaying plutonium. Both lose about 4 watts of power each year. Okay, let's see here. It says some project manager said, if we don't turn off an instrument on each Voyager now, they would probably have only a few months of power before we would need to declare end of mission. So that's what they have done. They've shut off some experiment packages and so forth. Then, on the 14th of May, I read a story from NASA that NASA's engineers at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Southern California have revived a set of thrusters aboard Voyager 1 that had been considered inoperable since 2004. Fixing the thrusters required creativity and risk, but the team wants to have them available as a backup to a set of active thrusters whose fuel tubes are experiencing a buildup of residue that could cause them to stop working as early as this fall. In addition, the mission needed to ensure the availability of the long-dormant thrusters before May 4th, when the Earth-bound antenna that sends commands to Voyager 1 and its twin Voyager 2 went offline for months of upgrades. The drama builds. Now, 3 days ago, there's a story at space.com of something of monumental importance. I'm sure you'll agree. The title of the article is, Why is the European Space Agency beaming a waltz at NASA's Voyager 1 probe this weekend? With its sweeping tempo and ethereal melody, Austrian composer Johann Strauss's Seconds, the Blue Danube Waltz, has become synonymous with outer space and science fiction ever since it was chosen by Stanley Kubrick for 1968's 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, the Blue Danube Waltz, with its whirling orbital rhythms, will truly become the music of the cosmos when the European when the European Space Agency broadcasts the lilting classical piece into deep space in celebration of the agency's 50th anniversary this year, in addition to the bicentennial of Johann Strauss II's birth in 1825. Performed by the Wiener Symphoniker, that's the Vienna Symphony Orchestra, this definitive anthem of space and sci-fi will be transmitted towards NASA's Voyager 1 probe by ESA's 35-meter deep space antenna in Cerebros, Spain. Yes, that's right, that's Cerebros, Spain. Space fans and music lovers can watch an entire 15-minute live stream on the event's official website and on their YouTube or Instagram channel, regardless of your location, starting at 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday, May 31st. So it looks like we missed it. Known in its native German as An der schönen blauen Donau, which translates into By the Beautiful Blue Danube, the sublime compositions, 13,743 notes are being broadcast into the interstellar void on a mission that is both a tribute to the past and a testament to the future, a Viennese waltz that will echo through space forever, according to the event's website. And then I'm going to skip a bunch of stuff, remarking how it's used in Kubrick's movie and how it was used on The Simpsons once. The King of Waltz's iconic musical masterpiece wasn't included in NASA's Voyager space probe's Golden Records, launched into space back in 1977, but this waltz into space aimed at Voyager 1 will correct that glowing oversight. Well, no, it really won't, will it? Currently, Voyager 1 is traveling 15.4 billion miles from Earth, taking this celebratory signal roughly 23 hours and 3 minutes to reach the historic spacecraft. And I think that's about enough news about Voyagers. And now for something completely different. A friend of mine sent me an article from the Jewish Chronicle. This is an article that connects the Jewish festival of Shavuot, which is Pentecost, which is coming up in a few days, to cheesecake. Yes, I know this is something that you probably pondered a great deal. The article is entitled "The Surprisingly Ancient History of Cheesecake" by Michael Leventhal. In just over a week, we'll be celebrating Shavuot with cheesecake. You may assume it would have its roots in the recent past, but the first recorded recipes show the dairy-based delicacy has been around far longer. The first cheesecake was developed in ancient Greece around 2000 BC, where it was served at weddings. Made from honey, cheese, and wheat, it was also believed to be a good source of energy, so was also prepared for athletes competing at the first ever Olympic Games in 776 BC in Olympia. The baked cheesecake you find today in Greece may not be so different from the one baked from those first recipes, but it moved on to other countries where it was transformed in countless ways. The ancient Romans conquered Greece in 146 BC and tweaked the recipe, adding crushed cheese and eggs, which they served warm as libuma cheesecake. In one of his essays, Cato the Elder describes a version made with layers of bay leaves. As the dessert traveled through Europe, numerous further variations were developed, but it wasn't until medieval times that cheesecake was reinvented again as a type of tart with a pastry base. And today, there are countless variations, from trendy Basque cheesecake and the ubiquitous New York baked cream cheese option, to a range of no-bake treats and the visually striking bright purple Filipino ube cheesecakes. I think it's ube perhaps. Someone will certainly correct me. How long have we been celebrating Shavuot with it? Well, Jews would probably have first tasted the cake in Greek-occupied Palestine, or else after the Roman victory, but it wasn't until relatively recently that it was really taken on by our community. Claudia Roden asserted that cheesecake was one of the first foods that Jews assimilated from their Central European neighbors, and the late food writer Gil Marx claimed that the tradition of Jewish cheesecake took off in the States in the 1930s with Ashkenazi eateries like Reuben's Restaurant or Lindy's on Broadway, spurred along by the invention of cream cheese by a New York dairyman. But as usual with Jewish traditions, there are plenty of competing explanations for why we eat cheesecake on Shavuot. I didn't know that Jews do eat cheesecake on Pentecost, Shavuot, but I guess they do. One practical explanation is that Shavuot falls in late spring or early summer, around the time when cows, sheep, and goats are giving birth, so farmers would have plenty of milk available. How do you use up all the milk? Make cheese and bake cheesecakes. A more prosaic reason is that Shavuot celebrates the giving of the Torah, when Israelites were promised a land flowing with milk and honey, so how better to celebrate than a cheesecake drizzled with melting honey? Another idea is that since the giving of the Torah has included new dietary laws with prohibitions on eating meat, Jews... Another idea is that since the giving of the Torah's included new dietary laws with prohibitions on eating meat, Jews chose to focus on dairy until the business of kashrut had been worked out. Okay, that was impenetrable to me. And let's not forget another Hebrew name for Mount Sinai is Mount Gavnunim. Probably Gavnunim. Etymologically related to Gevina, which, you guessed it, means cheese. And finally, the numerical reason given is that the Jews spent 40 days in the desert. Moses spent 40 days on Mount Sinai. There were 40 days praying for forgiveness for the golden calf. And the Hebrew word for milk is chalav, which also has the value of 40. Our writer then goes on to describe how he ate more than 40 cheesecakes in the last 40 days to research a cheesecake cookbook. And I'll spare you the rest of this. But in any event, cheesecake and Pentecost. The traditional Roman Missal has some lesser known Marian feasts that we can celebrate optionally, as the calendar permits. And they're tucked away in an appendix that's in the back of the missal for proper masses for certain occasions in different places. And just the other day, Saturday after Ascension, was the feast of Mary, Queen of Apostles. And I just happened to have received the newsletter from the wonderful Benedictines of Mary, Queen of Apostles, who are at Gower Abbey in Missouri. This is a wonderful place, and they have so many vocations that they're forming daughter houses. And here I'll share a little bit with the of this letter from the wonderful abbess there, Abbess Cecilia. Dear family friend, this is from the May 25th newsletter. Dear family, friends, and benefactors, Habemus Papam. Who could have known that we would be writing that greeting when we sent out our last newsletter? We begin a new chapter for the Church in these days, asking God's blessing on our new Pope Leo. May the Lord grant him clarity and strength in preaching the gospel to a world that has forgotten its Savior. That's a very nice way of putting that. Each of our houses has its own challenges, while many sisters get used to their surroundings. Of particular concern to us has been Colwich in England. After sending contingents over to help in the never-ending chore of cleaning and restoration, we found that sisters have been getting ill owing to the unsafe environment of the 18th-century building and its additions. We are not giving up, but the downward spiral of sisters' health has forced us to withdraw some from the foundation. The chapel is still quite usable, but we will be fixing up two guest houses in which the sisters can safely stay and oversee a more comprehensive, professional, and expensive renovation and building project. We have already spent months working with an architect, and the plans are quickly being formed. We have no doubt that the Lord has led us to save Colwich, and we must be patient with the fundraising and time it will take before it can host any sizable numbers of sisters safely. Please pray for our sick sisters, too. Now, this is brand new news to me. I didn't know about this, so I'm glad I chose to share this with you today. On a happier note, the St. Anne Chapel in Evansville is almost completed, and we are preparing to receive yet another very large group of postulants amongst the four houses. It's looking like 17 or more. Gosh, I wonder what the secret to their success is. So we do what we can with the space that we have, but if the Lord calls us to expand so further, we will not ignore that call. We continue to rely on your generous assistance and prayers and are most grateful for all the help you have given us thus far. May God reward you. In the hearts of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, Mother Cecilia. P.S. Don't forget about our novena of masses in honor of the Sacred Heart starting June 27th. And then there are some wonderful pictures. There are many, many photos. Matter of fact, most of the newsletter are photos of what's going on at their different places. At St. Anne's and Evansville, you can see the pictures of a chapel renovation, and one of the sisters is painting a Paschal candle. And they have an Easter egg hunt going on, a bunch of nuns wandering around with a basket in the trees, with baskets. They have at St. Joseph in Ava, Missouri, I think it's Ava, they have a picture of the building that they've made, which is magnificent. And to continue the cheesecake theme, they have Daisy the cow. They're dyeing some eggs. They have a beautiful picture of the chapel in Colwich that we were just talking about. They're singing matins. And they have new kids. They have goats. That continues also the theme. And there are some pictures of and another cow. And here they have a calf, PJ. And in Ephesus, at Gower, they are, let's see, what is she doing here? It looks like she's working in the garden. Oh, they found bunnies. So, anyway, that's what's going on with the sisters, the Benedictines, wonderful Benedictines of Gower Abbey and their daughter houses. I have here the newsletter of the Latin Liturgy Association, and this is number 149, and it would be the most recent, I think. I had two of them waiting for me when I got back, but let's see. Well, in any event, this is of timeless importance. The importance of the Sacrament of Penance, also known as Confession or Reconciliation, by Father Donald Kloster, excerpted from an email message received by Regina Morris on March 5th, 2025. Dear faithful, frequent confession is not just a pious platitude. The spiritual fathers down through the ages have advocated for the church militant in every vocation to go to regular confession at frequent intervals. Back in the 1970s, when it was still in line with sanity, the American Psychological Association said that Catholics were far less likely to need or seek psychiatric counseling than the general public. They attributed this to the fact that back then most Catholics were going to confession. Today, very few Catholics go to regular confession, and Catholics today are just as likely to seek psychiatric counseling than the general public. Confession helps fortify our mental health. You know, there's an old adage that sin makes you stupid. Well, maybe sin makes you crazy, too. As a priest with 30 years' experience, I can definitely affirm that confession, especially confession of only venial sins, is a great spiritual equalizer. The older standard was confession once a week. Today, we priests normally insist on confession at least once a month. If we let the interval get much longer, we forget certain sins that may be an obstacle to our spiritual advancement. Then, too, we could let the venial sins build up and lead to more intense temptations, allowing mortal sins occur, I think it should be to occur, or an attitude that presupposes our presumption of being able to go it alone without the sacramental help of God's own designs. Some good practical advice there from Father Donald Kloster. I see that this is starting to get a little long, so I will have one last piece for you and save some of the other things for another time. I have a priest friend who belongs to the SSPX, and he sent me a link to something from their news site. I imagine that this is also going to be in their printed newsletter too, but it's interesting enough to let you know about it right away. It's dated the 1st of June, which is as I speak as yesterday. And the title of the piece is A Pontificate at a Crossroads. Written in the 12th century, the prophecy of St. Malachy did not foresee a reign after that of Francis. What is certain is that the church has now reached a sort of crossroads, and that the pontificate inaugurated by Leo XIV must set a new course and a new impetus to steer Peter's bark forward on the turbulent waves of the world. The choice of a papal name is never trivial. It carries an intention, a program, and a vision. By opting for the name Francis, Jorge Bergoglio clearly announced the tone of his pontificate to demonstrate a desire to break with certain established traditions based on a biased interpretation of the spirit of reform initiated in the church by St. Francis of Assisi. The choice of Francis II would have signaled a desire to maintain a progressive course, but Benedict XVII's would have suggested a conservatism, that of a Second Vatican Council interpreted literally. Leo XIV, on the other hand, evokes a different perspective, closer to the disarmed and disarming peace evoked by the newly elected Pope in his first words from the Loggia of Blessings. It is a peace not only for states at war, but also, and perhaps above all, in a church that appears increasingly fragmented like many societies. For the name Leo XIV immediately evokes a long-term perspective beyond the political, theological, and ethical issues that have helped shape, often for the worse, the world of 2025. A pope of another century, Leo XIII is still appreciated for his contributions to the 19th century debates on capitalism and socialism, and for his support of the Thomist Renaissance. It is a legacy that transcends ideological divides, neither strictly left nor right. Leo XIV's choice could thus reflect an ambition not to resign himself to the current polarizations within the Church. After the tumultuous years of the previous pontificate, the conservative cardinals seem to have paved the way for Cardinal Prevost, a candidate who would not position himself as an adversary or a virulent critic of the Church's traditions. It seems he will avoid doctrinal reforms leading to schism or ideological battles, such as the one waged against the traditional Mass by Traditionis Custodes. In this scenario, which awaits an unfolding of the facts, the new pontiff could choose a more elevated stance, providing space for the Church's different tendencies. He could do this by avoiding creating a divide with each appointment, each synodal session, or each time there is a flying magisterium. This scenario would not be ideal, but in the current context, can we hope for another? Hence, conservative American Catholic writer Ross Douthat wonders in the columns of the New York Times whether the controversy surrounding adaptation or resistance to a secular and liberal modernity risks appearing out of step with the world, particularly on the American continent or in the states of the global south, where this form of modernity appears to be under attack. Similarly, British columnist Dan Hitchens explains on the website First Things that, under Francis, the Church has faced an increasingly anarchic and multipolar international landscape, marked by a crisis of confidence in the liberal order resulting from the supposedly happy but dying globalization, and a profound uncertainty about the political forces that will define the future. Paradoxically, the religiosity of the Western world seems to be entering a post-Christian era where... Okay, that's someone's pinging me on signal. Paradoxically, the religiosity of the Western world seems to be entering a post-Christian era where a vague spirituality still holds some position. For some, the crisis in the Church has not led to an abandonment of all forms of spirituality, but to a postmodern paganism blending supernatural, enchanted, magical, esoteric, and even occult ideas. In this context, the mysterious and supernatural dimension of Christianity, particularly in its enduring liturgy, a dimension perceived in the post-conciliar period as outdated in the age of an adult world, and to be consigned to oblivion along with the old popular devotions, could, on the contrary, become an essential asset for its survival and influence. Finally, caught in the web of contradictions between tradition and modernity, of which Vatican II will remain the acme, the Church has not yet managed to elucidate what it means to be a Christian in today's world, nor how Catholics should approach, from a moral and spiritual perspective, their relationship with a postmodern world marked by the emergence and captivating omnipresence of the digital age and new technologies. If Leo XIV were to reign as long as his distant predecessor Leo XIII, he would undoubtedly have time to thoroughly examine these questions before time ultimately runs out. A thought-provoking piece from the SFTX. I find it interesting that it deals with old devotions, which ties us to the beginning of this podcast. And also the reference here to, I think, artificial intelligence that was coming out there at the very end. This is something to be watched. I saw yesterday on YouTube a presentation of how one particular fellow who's very adept at creating videos using AI is making some truly astonishing things, and really rather terrifying in their reality. So this is something that we have to keep watch on. I'll wrap it up there for this edition of News of the Church. If you have any ideas about things, please drop me a line. Thanks for listening, and please pray for me as I will for you.